We are Kaiser Racing Radio day, what is this, Myron? I think it's day, must be day six, into Koyukuk, down the Hooslea River. How you feeling? You were a little under the weather yesterday.
I was. I had that feeling like I didn't want to go for a long run at 40 below.
Well, given that we were in the land of George Atla, the question goes without, we have to ask the question of how you're George passed this year and the whole thing. You kind of have a storied career with is that the closest race ever finish? Was it closer than the one that Mackey and Swenson had?
Yeah, second closest finish in race history, as far as I know, in dog race history, yes.
Well, can you give us just a little rundown of the last bit there?
Well, I can. I came upon George, stopped on the trail about 5 miles above Kweepluk, and we traded the lead probably 10 times between there and Bethel because we were having a hard time finding the trail. We were using a back trail from Kweepluk home because of water on the trail and other reasons, and so they routed us around through the trees back there, what is locally known as the Disneyland Trail. And we ended up just kind of trading back and forth without any real pattern to it. We came out on the river about 4 miles above Bethel, near the mouth at this end of Church Slough. And there's a bunch of overflow there, and that overflow went over what was the normal trail that my team was used to. George's team took a left to go around the overflow. Mine looked like they were going to go through, and I thought, oh, great. I'm going to get a lead because my dogs are just going to go straight here, and his are going to go around. But we got about halfway out of the water, got too deep, and so we retreated, and now we had to catch up again. I remember a bunch of people from Bethel were up there at about 4:30 in the morning cheering me on. Mike Chance was one of them, as a matter of fact. And we caught up with George rather quickly. I had noticed from Kweepluk down that my team was slightly stronger than his, but that doesn't mean everything. You know, there's a lot more going on at that stage of a race and which team is stronger. And now we were in no man's land, so you had to pass on your own. You couldn't ask for the trail. And as soon as you hit the river, that's where no man's land started. So I followed him down another couple miles. Bob Sepp, famous veterinarian Bob Sepp, had provided me with a brand new signal whip before the race, which I had never used before in my life, and I didn't really know how to use. But I had it coiled to the bottom of my sled. I pulled it out when the lights of Bethel showed up. As we came around the bend there, you could see Bethel pretty clearly. And I thought, well, if I'm ever going to pass this guy, I better be right now. So I got this whip out, tried to snap it. It wouldn't snap. I didn't know how. But then I started hitting on the ice with it, which made a pretty good little noise. And it had no effect on my old leader, Funny. He just kept going the same speed, about 2 feet behind George's sled. We just were trotting right along, enjoying ourselves. So I put this whip away, and we went on down towards Bethel, and both teams tried to turn into the mouth of Brown Slough, where a trail went in, but we got him squared away, and George was still ahead by 2 feet, and we came up to where the trail was going to leave the river. The trail left the river right about where the city dock is now. There was a little passageway there between a big boat and sort of a rudimentary bank that was still standing there, a mud bank. So there's just a little passageway between there. And as I say, there was a bunch of overflow on the river that night, and in that little cut going up to Front Street, there was a bunch of water. And George was first going in there, and he got completely in the middle of the water, and his team stopped. Well, here's my chance. So I told mine to go by. Old Funny was in lead, single lead at the time. And they made it partway past him. And then one of George's dogs jumped over the tug line. So now we were tangled.
Oh, no.
So George, being a savvy old guy, says to me immediately, he says, get him. And what he meant by that was, you go up there and untangle him, thinking that that would give him the advantage, of course. And it probably would have, you know. I mean, but somebody had to do it, and everybody knows that George is the king of mushing, and if he tells me to get him, I'm going to get him. I might add, I know that he has a fused leg, and getting around on a bunch of overflow and covering glare ice is probably not the best idea.
Sure.
So I ran up, and I didn't put a hook in or anything like that. I was thinking, too, of course. And I got to the dog that was over the line, and I picked him up, and I tossed him back to his correct side at exactly the same moment as I told my dog to go to the finish line. Now, we had been over this trail a few days earlier in preparation for the race, and so my dog, my old leader, 10-year-old leader, knew exactly where home was. And when I told him to go, he went, and I caught the sled as it came by. We came out of the water. I was in 2-3 feet of water when I said that. The sled came by. I grabbed it. I got to the top of the bank. I looked back, and George was still knee-deep in water. And I beat him to the finish line by 18 seconds.
And those are the days when the K300 came through Front Street, so it was a very similar kind of race to how Nome is, where it comes into town, and you had people. Was there a lot of folks there?
There were. I mean, that was only the fourth year of the race, and even though it was like 5 in the morning, there was a big crowd of people there, a noisy crowd of people, and it was quite a scene.
Sure. Well, tell me, in George's career, you know, he was known for sprint. Was this his first foray into the mid-distance? And he didn't ever do the Iditarod, did he?
Oh, yeah. He finished the first Iditarod, and he claimed it was the most miserable time of his life. And he never went back. But he came out here in 1982 to race in Bethel, and he finished second behind Jerry Austin. And swore off ever coming again because he said, I kept remembering the Iditarod. And every time I thought about the Iditarod, I got miserable all over again. So, but the next year, his son had trained the team and was planning on racing, but something went haywire right at the end. So George just said, well, I'll come out and race those dogs. So he kind of did at the last minute and showed up and raced them.
The rest is history. So he wasn't a happy camper, I take it.
No, he said at the finish line, he said he told me, well, young boy or boy, I think you broke every rule in the book. That was a quote. And I said, well, take it up with the race marshal, George. So he did, and he complained that I had used a whip. And there was no rule against the use of a whip, and so the race marshal announced in about 10 seconds that there was no violation, And then George got upset by that and got on the next jet out of town and skipped our banquet.
Right. And, yeah. Well, I had to chuckle because he came out 2 or 3 years ago, and apparently, as luck would have it, Alaska Airlines seated you next to each other.
No, he was a few rows away. I remember the flight. He was a few rows away, but he doesn't even really know who I am, I'm sure, anymore. I, of course, recognize him because he's kind of stayed in the news and that sort of thing, but he would have had no idea that I was on the plane, I'm sure.
Okay, well, that would have been a great story. Well, on to today's activities. We're seeing a bunch of strategies play out. Did you see Aaron Burmeister's team on the Insider come into Koyukuk?
I did not.
They looked really nice, beautiful looking team. Smile, you know, just really nice looking team. And of course, Aaron is fairly positive, so he was looking pretty good as well. The thing that's been not bothering me, but in the back of my mind is how Jeff pulled off such a quick run. I mean, he's a couple of hours faster than everyone else on that run.
Which run are you speaking of?
From Huslia to Koyukuk.
Yeah, well, here's why. He went nonstop. And the Indy anybody's guess as to why he did that, but there's two or three things that are worth commenting on that. First of all, it was really cold. And I think you could fairly say that when King took his 24-hour break in Galena, he had in mind a nonstop run to Uslia, a decent break, and then a nonstop run back to Koyukuk, because, you know, that's better than camping on the trail. Even our youngster, Richie Deal, said that trying to get a nap at 40 below is really a problem.
Right. Well, you know, Wade Mars did it as well. He I think, is in the 11s. But I just wonder, you know, a lot of other folks are taking the break and taking breaks. Jor and Pete seem to be, and Jesse Royer seem to be traveling together. They are into Koyukuk now. When the race gets to this point, at what point in the race do the mushers look at the finish line? I mean, you know, it would seem that they would maintain to a certain point and then start doing other things. Like Aaron, for example, in Koyukuk, dropped his little pony sled and looked like he was looking at the finish already. At what point do you look at the finish when you're 400 miles out?
Well, they have to be thinking about it, and especially if you're behind. Because if you're behind, you got to figure out how you're going to make up the difference. And if you're doing it with speed, you got to figure, well, I'm moving a mile an hour faster than this guy. How soon do I have to match his rests in order to catch him if I match his rests? And the mathematics can be done. It, you know, you have to sit there and figure it out, but you get a lot of time sitting on the sled to figure out how much you're going to gain in the next 10 hours. If it's 1 mile an hour, you gain 10 miles. And, you know, that's how it works. But on the other hand, if you're slower, you have to figure out how much rest am I going to have to cut just to keep up. And these guys know who's faster and who's slower. There's no question about that. There's a lot of different ways of figuring that out, but one is they've seen them on the trail. And if you're 400 miles out and you've got, you know, how many rests left, 6 or 8 rests or something like that, however many it is, hey, I got to chop an hour off every one if I'm going to have a chance of making up that 5 or 6 hours I'm behind.
Sure. So you would.
So there's a lot of different factors that come into it, but they know now, especially with Unic Week coming up. There's a pretty well a rule of thumb in the Iditarod anymore that if you're not in a really good position to win at Unic Week, you're not going to win. Now, of course, last year showed that was not always the case. But you can't count on a big storm bailing you out every year. And so you need to be in position at Unic Week. So they're jockeying now to see who's going to be in position at Unic Week. Because from there on, nobody's lollygagging. Everybody's taking minimal rest. And they're going as fast as they possibly can. So making up time from there is very difficult.
Right. Well, and you know, Sebastian was talking today on his column about it seems to be three groups in the top 10. You have, you know, Jeff and maybe Allie, Mitch, Dallas, and then you have this second group that, well, and Aaron's, what do you think, what do you make of Aaron with not having the 8 yet, but really, you know, in the top 3 as he comes into checkpoints?
Well, there's a couple things to make of Aaron. Number one, he has the lowest speed among the top contenders right now, average moving speed for the race at 8.1. And that's a significant factor to consider because he's going to have to adjust his race accordingly. And there's a good chance that he's going to be leaving Unic Week a little bit behind somebody.
Right.
Because he has to take his 8 hours there.
Well, we're 400 miles from the finish. Who are you looking at besides Jeff King? And Jeff seems to be, you know, it's you have to, at least I do, look at Jeff King and marvel to think about you know, all of the races that revolve around watching him at this point in the race. I mean, you think of the coffee cup and Uniclete with Lance Mackey and all of these things. I mean, this guy really is motivated to win. But in terms
of... Probably a couple things about King. First of all, his speed is not as high as a couple of teams behind him. That's a factor. However, part of that has to do with the fact that he's taking these long runs, which tends to grind him down just a little bit at the end of those runs. That's how that works.
So who do you see as the... Who do you see as in the... Say we're looking at top five of folks.
Well, top five is pretty... I would call it... The top five right now would have to be Burmeister, King, Zirkel, and the two Seavies. However, there is an interloper there that I first noticed yesterday. I don't know if I'm pointing it out to you, but Jesse Royer completely flew from Galena to Huslia.
Right. Yeah.
Completely flew. I mean, just an absolute astounding speed, and she's keeping it up today.
Yeah.
So that's a person who has just entered the picture. Her traveling speed for the race is 9.2.
Whoa.
That's a full mile an hour faster than Burmeister, faster than Dallas at 8.7 by half a mile an hour. And half a mile an hour in dog racing is a significant advantage.
Sure.
And the next ones are...
Jor and Pete.
Jor and Pete are in the 8.6 range, somewhere in there.
Right.
Mitch, 8.5. So what do we have? We have these teams that are a little bit to the front that I think you could fairly say have squandered a little of their speed by getting to the front. That's how it works. I mean, you don't get to the front without some wear and tear.
So you play your hand too early?
Well, no, I didn't say that. That's their strategy, is to get a lead so that they know where they stand at all times and they do different things to stay in the race. And one of the things is this. Excuse me. This kind of works to their advantage if this is the way they're playing it. You use your speed early to get in a good position, and the dogs then start traveling at a reduced speed, which is less wear and tear on the dogs. And once they get into that reduced speed, which is less wear and tear on the dogs, then you feel comfortable going further with a run because they're not exhausting themselves by the speed they're going down the trail. So maybe that's what's going on. Burmeister had an awfully high speed in the first couple days of the race. Really
sure. Right.
And now he's going 8.1, and you said you saw a video of him, they looked beautiful coming into a checkpoint. That's maybe where they're most comfortable. And one thing to remember about Burmeister, I think it's important to remember that he is unusually determined this year. I mean, I'm not sure what the motivation was, but I have noticed throughout the year that he has expressed great determination to try to win this race this year. So that figures in somewhere. I think he's a guy that can stay in the trail a long time, no matter what the circumstances. So that's important to consider. Once he pulls the hook there in Caltag, I think you're going to see some long runs out of him. Now, Zirkel has always been driven in terms of her determination. That's just something that...
Well, considering last year especially, where, you know, she had to watch Dallas drive by. I mean, and you know, it's kind of like the poor coach for the Seahawks that has to remember that play for the whole year. Let's talk about that for a little bit. You have King, who had it in the bag, and Zirkel, who were right there. As a person, as a musher, does that provide extra motivation? Where, I mean, I'm sure it does, but I mean, when you have a guy like King and Zirkel that have been around for a long time, do they just shed it off, or does that really drive them even that much harder?
Well, I'm sure in Zirkel's case, it drives her. She's been second too often, or, you know, I don't know, what is it, 3 years in a row now? I don't keep track of the old stats very good, but she's been second too often. Her husband just got second in another race. I'm sure she's sick of that. And so, in her case, I'd give determination one of the high grades in her favor.
Sure.
Now let's talk about King then when it comes to that. He's won four times. He's no kid. And the reports from the trail are that he, you know, they're all tired. They're entitled to be very tired. But he looks especially so tired, they say, from the trail.
Right.
And that's why he's taking long runs, I think, so he has a little better chance to have a nap at the next checkpoint inside. But with four wins under your belt, at somewhere around the age of 60, he probably does not have the staying power that a kid does.
Right.
And, you know, that's not to take away from him. He's obviously got more staying power than you or I, John. Okay?
Well, sure, but I mean, yeah, I totally get what you're saying. I mean, Aaron is 39, Pete is 27. You know, it just goes down, down, down. These kids, I remember that one year where Ramey Smith basically ran up the coast, you know, a young guy that just kicked the whole way and into third place. And
yeah, and even Mitch, they're saying, is not doing much but sit in his sled this year. And, you know, they comment on that because the younger guys are working hard and bowling and that sort of stuff. So that, I think, works against Jeff, especially also you must consider that he has had some issues finishing the last couple times as strong as he'd like. Not last year was an unusual circumstance, but there are other couple of years where it hasn't gone well for him as well.
Right. You know, I remember the Unicleat thing that had to be really a downer. Well, it was enough of a downer for him to go on a motorcycle trip for the next year, you remember? Buy a pet pig and off you go. Well, let's talk about guys like Jor and Pete that are just out of the mix. That, you know,
let me see what I can say about those. I've been watching them very carefully, those three. Royer, Pete, and Jor. All three of them are moving at a better clip than some of the people ahead of them. That in and of itself makes them a threat to move up. Moving up to first for any of the three is very, very difficult because they have too many teams to pass.
Right.
If there was one team ahead of them that they could focus on and hope that team faltered in some way, their chances would be much better. It's like in baseball league, you know, if you're five games behind but there's four teams in front of you in a pennant drive, all one team after you have to do is win a little bit and you're not going to make it. So that really hurts them, but you can't rule out, even for any of those three, that they could possibly find an opening to get to the front. Possibly. But that doesn't mean that their chances of moving up are poor. They're probably going to move up because here's what happens. When you get five teams ahead of you that are jockeying for a win, it's likely that one or two of them are going to pull out all the stops and fail.
Right.
And then they say, you know, I'm going to pull over here for a few hours and recover.
Right.
That happens frequently.
Sure.
And if that happens and these guys are still moving at a good clip, they're going to lap those guys.
Yeah. Well,
there's one more team that's worth mentioning. That's the Norwegian.
Definitely. Werner.
Werner. And here's why he's worth mentioning. The Norwegians, historically, in the Iditarod, have had a manner of running that's a little bit different than we do over here. They are capable of, and they train for, staying on the trail forever.
Right.
And with that in mind, this guy looks like his speed is such that the team could go on forever. You know, if you're a little bit slower, that gives them the potential of going longer without stopping. And the drivers themselves, you know, they wouldn't send a guy over here all the way from Norway to race with their grand tradition if he wasn't capable of doing that himself.
No, and with three teams. That's kind of like when America sends its basketball team to the Olympics. They take the best of the best, and that's the first thing I thought of with the Norwegian team is you got national pride, you've got a lot of things. Now, is he financed by the government? I mean, is this a national deal?
I don't know that, but I do know that when they've come over here, they've had for the most part, really decent teams and decent drivers.
Now, in the European racing, do they? Is it all stage racing, or is it, like this, where they have?
No, they have had. They've had one over there that's been a typical distance race from over here, and not stage race at all.
Right. Now, one last thing before I let you go. I was doing some calculations, and even with the 2003 race, this is so we're on Saturday, and that means a Tuesday finish. A Tuesday finish with a Monday start is a pretty darn fast race.
Well, it is, but it's quite a different race than they're used to having. That flat trail makes a big difference, and mileage, we'll eventually find out the exact mileage, but you never know for sure until it's over.
Right, right. All right, Myron, well, it's been a fun show. We're right at 30 minutes. That's a little longer than we normally do, but there's a lot going on, and we'll talk to you again. I hope you feel better.
Thank you.
All right, see you now.
Bye.